I caught to a telepathic message to someone at the Potala, someone who had to go to the inmost one in a hurry to give a detailed report. But my interception of the telepathic message was interrupted by the entry of a servant bringing food and tea. I sat back, replete with food, feeling even more uncomfortably full. I had had a hard day, I had been hungry for many, many hours, but, the thought troubled me internally, had I eaten too much too unwisely now? Suddenly, suspiciously, I looked up. My guide was gazing down upon me with obvious amusement on his face. "Yes, Lobsang," he remarked, "you have eaten too much. I hope you will be able to follow my talk on hypnotism." He studied my flushed face and his own look softened. "Poor Lobsang, you have had a hard day. Go to your rest now and we will continue our discussion on the morrow." He rose to his feet and left the room. I climbed wearily to mine and almost tottered along the corridor. Sleep. That was all I wanted. Food? For. I had had too much of that. I reached my bed place and rolled myself in my robes. Sleep was troubled indeed. I had nightmares in which legless Chinese chased me through wooded groves and other Chinese armed with guns kept jumping on my shoulders in an attempt to bring me down. Thump. Went my head on the ground. One of the Chinese guards was kicking me. Thump. Went my head again. Blearily I opened my eyes to find an acolyte energetically banging my head and kicking me in a desperate attempt to wake me. "Lobsang," he exclaimed as he saw that my eyes were open. "Lobsang, I thought you were dead. You have slept all through the night, missed the services, and only the intervention of your master, the Lama Minya Dondup, has saved you from the proctors. Wake up!" he shouted, as I almost lapsed into sleep again. Consciousness flooded into me. Through the windows I saw the early morning rays of sunlight peering over the high Himalayas and lighting up the tallest buildings in the valley, showing the golden roofs of the distant Sura, glowing along the top of the Pagokling. Yesterday I had gone to the village of Sho. Ah! That was not a dream. Today I hoped to miss some lessons and learn direct from my beloved Minya Dondup. Learn about hypnotism, too. Soon I had finished my breakfast and was on my way to the classroom, not to stay and recite from the 108 sacred books, but to explain why I was not. "Sir," I said, as I saw the teacher just going into the classroom, "Sir, I have to attend the Lama Minya Dondup this day. I beg to be excused from class." "Ah, yes. My boy," said the teacher in amazingly genial tones. "I have had a word with the Holy Lama, your guide. He was good enough to comment favorably upon your progress under my care. I confess I am most gratified, most gratified." Astonishingly, he extended his hand and patted me upon the shoulder before entering the classroom. Bemused, and wondering what sort of magic had been worked upon him, I wandered off towards the Lama's quarters. On I strolled without a care in the world. Past a half-opened doorway. "Ow!" I exclaimed suddenly, coming to a sudden stop. "Pickled walnuts?" The scent of them was strong. Backtracking silently, I peered through the doorway. An old monk was staring down at the stone floor, muttering things which were not his prayers, mourning the loss of a whole jar of pickled walnuts which had somehow been obtained from India. "May I help you, Reverend Lama?" I asked politely. The old man turned a ferocious face to me and made such a rejoinder that I raced off along the corridor while I was still able. "All those words just for a few walnuts?" I said disgustedly to myself. "Come in," said my guide as I approached his door. "I thought you had gone back to sleep." "Sir," I said, "I have come to you for instruction. I am anxious to know the nature of hypnotism." "Lobsang," said my guide, "you have to learn much more than that. You have to learn the basis for hypnotism first. Otherwise you do not know exactly what you do. Sit down." I sat, cross-legged of course, upon the floor. My guide sat opposite me. For a time he seemed lost in thought, and then said, "By now you should have realized that everything is vibration, electricity. The body has many different chemicals in its composition. Certain of those chemicals are conveyed to the brain by the bloodstream. The brain, you know, has the best supply of blood and its contained chemicals. Those ingredients, potassium, manganese, carbon, and many others, form the brain tissue. Interaction between them makes a peculiar oscillation of molecules which we term an electric current. When one thinks, one sets in motion a chain of circumstances which results in the formulation of this electric current and, hence, brain waves. I pondered the whole matter. I could not see all this. If there were electric currents in my brain, why did I not feel the shock? That boy who was flying a kite, I recalled, had been doing so in a thunderstorm. I remembered the vivid blue flash as lightning traveled along his wet kite line. I remembered, with a shudder, how he had fallen to the ground as a dried up, fried crisp of flesh. And once I too had had a shock from the same source, a mere tingle compared to the other, but tingle enough to throw me a dozen feet. Honorable Lama, I expostulated, how can there be electricity in the brain? It would drive a man mad with the pain. My guide sat and laughed at me. Lobsang, he chuckled, the shock you once had has given you a wholly incorrect idea of electricity. The amount of electricity in the brain is of a very small order indeed. Delicate instruments can measure it and can actually chart the variations as one thinks or undertakes some physical action. The thought of one man measuring another man's voltage was almost too much for me. I started to laugh. My guide merely smiled and said, "Let us this afternoon walk over to the Potala. The inmost one has there a device which will enable us to talk more easily on this electrical subject. Go now and entertain yourself, have a meal, put on your best robe and meet me here when the sun is at noon." I rose to my feet, bowed, and went out. For 2 hours I wandered around, climbing to the roof and idly flicking small pebbles onto the unsuspecting heads of monks passing below. Tiring of that sport, I lowered myself headfirst through a trap hatch leading down to a dark corridor. Hanging upside down by my feet, I was just in time to hear approaching footsteps. I could not see, because the trap hatch was at a corner. Sticking out my tongue, and making a ferocious face, I waited. An old man came round the corner and, not being able to see me, bumped into me. My wet tongue touched his cheek. He emitted a shriek, and dropping the tray he was carrying with a crash, he disappeared at a speed surprising in such an old man. I too had a surprise. As the old monk bumped into me, it dislodged my feet from their precarious hold. I fell on my back into the corridor. The trap hatch fell with a resounding crash and a whole load of choking dust fell on top of me. Scrambling dizzily to my feet, I made off as fast as I could in the opposite direction. Still suffering from the shock, I changed my robe and had a meal. I was not shocked enough to forget that. Punctually, as the shadows vanished, and the day was at noon, I presented myself before my guide. With some effort he composed his features as he saw me. An elderly monk, Lobsang, swears that he was beset by a devil in the north corridor. A party of three lamas has gone there to exorcise the devil. No doubt I shall be doing my part if I take him, you, to the Potala as arranged. Come." He turned and walked out of the room. I followed behind, casting apprehensive glances about me. After all, one never knew for sure what would happen if the lamas were exorcising. I had vague visions of finding myself flying through the air to some unknown, probably uncomfortable, destination. Out we went, into the open. Two ponies are being held by grooms. The Lama Minyadon up mounted and slowly rode off down the mountain. I was helped onto my pony, and one of the grooms playfully gave him a slap. The pony felt playful too. Down went his head. Up went his rear, and off his back in an arc went I. A groom again held the animal while I picked myself from the ground and brushed off some of the dust. Then I mounted again, watching warily in case the grooms tried anything else. That pony knew he had a duffer aboard. The moronic animal kept walking to the most dangerous places and stopping on the very edge. Then he would lower his head and gaze earnestly at the rocky ground so far below. At last I dismounted and towed the pony behind me. It was quicker. At the bottom of Iron Mountain I again mounted and followed my guide into the village of Sho. He had some business there which detained us for a few moments. Time enough for me to regain my breath and my shattered composure. Then, mounting again, we climbed up the broad, stepped way to the potala. Gladly I relinquished my pony to the waiting grooms. Even more gladly I followed the Lama Minyadon up to his own apartment. My pleasure was increased by the knowledge that I should be staying here for a day or so. Soon it was time to attend the service in the temple below. Here at the potala, services were, I thought, excessively formal, the discipline too strict. Having had more than enough of excitement for one day, as well as suffering from many small bruises, I remained on my best behavior and the service was concluded without incident. It was now an accepted thing that when my guide was at the potala I should occupy a small room adjoining his. I went there and sat down to await events, knowing that the Lama Minyadon Dup was engaged in matters of state with a very senior official who had recently returned from India. It was fascinating to look out of the window and see the city of Lhasa in the distance. The view was one of surpassing beauty, willow-fringed lakes, golden gleams from the Jokhang, and the milling throng of pilgrims who clamored at the foot of the holy mountain in the hope of seeing the inmost one, who was in residence, or at least some high official. An interminable string of traders and their beasts were just wending their slow way past the Pagokling. I dwelt for a moment upon their exotic clothes, but was interrupted by a soft footstep behind me. "We will have tea, Lobsang, and then we will continue with our talk," said my guide who had just entered. I followed him to his room where was laid out fare very different from that normally served to a poor monk. Tea, of course, but sweet things from India too. It was all very much to my taste. Normally monks never talk when they eat, it is considered to be disrespectful to the food, but on this occasion my guide told me that the Russians were attempting to make trouble for Tibet, were attempting to infiltrate spies. Soon we finished our meal and then made our way to the rooms where the Dalai Lama stored many strange devices from far-off lands. For a time we just looked about us, the Lama Minyadon up pointing out odd objects and explaining their uses. At last he stopped in a corner of one room and said, "Look at this, Lobsang." I moved to his side and was not at all impressed with what I saw. Before me, on a small table, stood a glass jar. Inside there depended two thin threads, each supporting at their far end a small sphere of something that appeared to be pith from a willow tree. "It is pith," commented my guide dryly, when I remarked upon the matter. "You, Lobsang," said the Lama, "think of electricity as something that gives you a shock. There is another kind, or manifestation, which we term static electricity. Now watch." From the table the Lama Minyadon up took a shiny rod, possibly about 12 to 14 inches long. Briskly he rubbed the rod on his robe and then brought it close to the glass jar. To my intense surprise the two pith spheres flew violently apart, and stayed apart even when the rod was withdrawn. "Keep watching," exhorted my guide. Well, that is what I was doing. After some minutes the pith balls slowly sank down again under the normal pull of gravity. Soon they were hanging straight down as they had before the experiment. "You try it," commanded the Lama, extending the black rod to me. "By the blessed Dolma," I cried, "I'm not touching that thing." My guide laughed heartily at my more than distressed expression. "Try it, Lobsang," he said mildly, "for I have never played a trick on you yet." "Yes," I grumbled, "but there is always a first time." He pressed the rod upon me. Gingerly I took the awful object. Reluctantly, half-heatedly, expecting a shock at any moment, I rubbed the rod on my robe. There was no sensation, no shock or tingle. At last I held it toward the glass jar and, wonder of wonders, the pith balls flew apart again. "As you observe, Lobsang," remarked my guide, "electricity is flowing, yet even you feel no shock. Such is the electricity of the brain. Come with me." He led me to another table upon which rested a most remarkable device. It appeared to be a wheel upon whose surface there were innumerable metal plates. Two rods were fixed so that a spray of wires from each lightly touched two of the metal plates. From the rods wires trailed to two metal spheres which were about a foot apart. The thing made no sense at all to me. Statue of a devil, I thought. My guide confirmed that impression by his next move. Grasping a handle which projected from the back of the wheel, he gave it a very hearty twirl. With a growl of rage, the wheel sprang to life, flashing and winking. From the metal spheres, a great tongue of blue lightning leapt, hissing and crackling. There was a strange smell, as if the air itself were burning. I waited no longer. This most definitely was not the place for me. I dived beneath the biggest table and tried to wriggle my way to the far distant door. The hissing and crackling stopped, to be replaced by another sound. I checked my flight and listened in amazement. Was it the sound of laughter? Never. Nervously, I peered from my sanctuary. There was the Lama Minyodon up, almost doubled up with laughter. Tears of merriment were trickling from his eyes, while his face was red with amusement. He seemed to be gasping for breath, too. "Oh, Lobsang," he said at last, "that is the first time I have known anyone to be frightened of a Wimshurst machine. These devices are used in many foreign countries that the properties of electricity may be demonstrated." I crept out, feeling rather silly, and had a closer look at the strange machine. The Lama said, "I will hold these two wires, Lobsang, and you turn the handle as fast as you can. You will see lightning flash all over me, but it will not harm me nor cause me pain. Let us try. Who knows? Perhaps you will have an opportunity to laugh at me." He took two wires, one in each hand, and nodded for me to start. Grimly, I seized the handle and turned as fast as I could. I shouted in amazement as great purple and violet bands of lightning streamed across my guide's hands and face. He was quite unperturbed. Meanwhile, the smell had started again. "Ozone, quite harmless," said my guide. At last, I was persuaded to hold the wires with the Lama turning the handle. The hissing and crackling was fearsome in the extreme, but as for feeling, it was more like a cool breeze than anything else. The Lama took various glass things from a box and one by one connected them to the machine by wires. As he turned the handle, I saw a bright flame burning inside a glass bottle, and, in other bottles, across and other metal shapes outlined by living fire. But nowhere could I get a feeling of electric shock. With this Wimshurst machine, my guide demonstrated how a person who was not clairvoyant could be unable to see the human aura, but more of that later. Eventually, the fading light caused us to desist from our experiments and to return to the Lama's room. First, there was the evening service again. Our life in Tibet seemed to be completely circumscribed by the needs for religious observance. With the service behind us, we returned once again to my guide the Lama Minyodon Up's apartment. Here we sat in our usual cross-legged attitude upon the floor with the little table, perhaps 14 inches high, between us. "Now, Lobsang," said my guide, "we have to get down to this matter of hypnotism. But first of all, we have to decide upon the operation of the human brain. I have shown you, I hope, that there can be the passage of an electric current without one experiencing pain or discomfort therefrom. Now, I want you to consider that when a person thinks he generates an electric current, we need not go into the matter of how an electric current stimulates muscle fiber and causes reaction. Our whole interest for the moment is the electric current, the brain waves, which have been so clearly measured and charted by Western medical science." I confess that I found this to be of some interest to me, because in my small and humble way it had already occurred to me that thought had force, because I remembered that parchment roughly perforated cylinder which I had used at times in the Lamasery, and which I had caused to rotate by thought power alone. "Your attention is wandering, Lobsang," said my guide. "I am sorry, honorable master," I replied. "I was merely reflecting upon the undoubted nature of thought waves, and considering the amusement I derived from that cylinder to which you introduced me some months ago." My guide looked at me and said, "You are an entity, an individual, and you have your own thoughts. You may consider that you will do some course of action, such as lift that rosary. Even in considering an action, your brain causes electricity to flow from its chemical constituents, and the wave from the electricity prepares your muscle for the impending action. If a greater electrical force should occur in your brain, then your original intention of lifting that rosary would be thwarted. It is easy to see that if I can persuade you that you cannot lift that rosary, then your brain, being beyond your immediate control, will generate and send out an opposing wave. You will then be unable to lift the rosary or do the contemplated action. I looked at him, and thought of the affair, and it really did not make much sense to me, for how could he influence how much electricity my brain was generating? I thought about it, and looked at him, and wondered if I should voice my doubt. There was no necessity to, however, for he divined it and hastened to set my mind at rest. I can assure you, Lobsang, that what I say is demonstrable fact, and in a Western country we should be able to prove all this under a piece of apparatus which would chart the three basic brain waves. Here, however, we have no such facilities and we can only debate the matter. The brain generates electricity, it generates waves, and if you decide to lift your arm then your brain generates waves on the intention of your decision. If I can, in rather technical words, feed a negative charge into your brain, then your original intention would be frustrated. In other words, you would be hypnotized. This really did begin to make sense. I had seen that Wim Hof machine, and I had seen various demonstrations conducted with its assistance, and I had seen how it was possible to alter the polarity of a current and so cause it to flow in the opposite direction. "Honorable Lama," I exclaimed, "how is it possible for you to feed a current into my brain? You cannot take off the top of my head and put some electricity inside. How then may it be done?" "My dear Lobsang," said my guide, "it is not necessary to get into your head because I do not have to generate any electricity and put into you. I can make appropriate suggestions whereby you will be convinced of the accuracy of my statement or suggestions, and you will then, without any voluntary control on your part, generate that negative current yourself." He looked at me and said, "I am most unwilling to hypnotize anyone against their will except in a case of medical or surgical necessity, but I think that with your cooperation it might be a good idea to demonstrate a simple little matter of hypnotism." I exclaimed hastily, "Oh yes, I should love to experience hypnotism." He rather smiled at my impetuosity and asked, "Now, Lobsang, what would you be unwilling to do, normally?" "I ask you that because I want to hypnotize you into doing something that you would not willingly do so that you personally can be assured that in doing this thing you are acting under involuntary influence." I thought for a moment, and really I hardly knew what to say, there were so many things that I did not want to do. I was saved further thought on this matter by my guide, who exclaimed, "I know. You were not at all anxious to read that rather involved passage in the fifth volume of the Kaniya. You were, I believe, rather afraid that some of the terms used would betray you, and betray the fact that on that particular subject you had not studied so assiduously as desired by your tutor. I felt rather gloomy about that, and I confess I also felt my cheeks redden with some embarrassment." It was perfectly true. There was a particularly difficult passage in the book which caused me extreme difficulty. However, in the interests of science I was quite prepared to be persuaded to read it. Actually I had almost a phobia against reading that particular passage. My guide smiled and said, "The book is over there just to the side of the window, bring it here, turn to that passage and read it aloud, and if you will try not to read it, if you will try to mess up the whole thing, then that will be a much better test." I reluctantly went across and fetched the book, and unwillingly turned over the pages. Our Tibetan pages are much bigger, much heavier, than Western books. I fumbled and fumbled, and made the thing as long drawn out as possible. In the end, though, I turned to the appropriate passage, and I confess that this particular passage, because of some earlier incident with a tutor, really did make me feel almost physically sick. I stood there with the book in front of me, and try as I might I could not articulate those words. It may seem strange but it is a fact that because I had been so ill-used by an ununderstanding tutor I had developed a real hatred for those sacred sentences. My guide looked at me, nothing more, just looked at me, and then something seemed to click inside my head, and I found to my very considerable surprise that I was reading, not just reading but reading fluently, easily, without a trace of hesitation. As I reached the end of the paragraph one had the most inexplicable sensation. I put down the book and I went to the middle of the room and I stood on my head. I'm going crazy, I thought. Whatever will my guide think of me for behaving in this utterly foolish manner? Then it occurred to me that my guide was making me, influencing me, to behave thus. Quickly I jumped to my feet, and found that he was smiling most benevolently upon me. It really is a most easy matter, Lobsang, to influence a person. There is no difficulty at all when one has mastered the basic matter. I merely thought of certain things and you picked up my thoughts telepathically, and that caused your brain to react in the manner I had anticipated. Thus certain fluctuations in your normal brain pattern were caused which produced this quite interesting result. Honorable Lama, I said, then does it mean that if we can put an electric current into a person's brain we can make that person do anything we want? No, it does not mean that at all, said my guide. It means instead that if we can persuade a person to do a certain course of action, and the course of action which we desire to persuade is not contrary to that person's belief, then he will undoubtedly do it merely because his brain waves have been altered, and no matter what his original intention, he will react as suggested by the hypnotist. In most cases a person receives suggestions from a hypnotist. There is no real influence exerted by the hypnotist other than the influence of suggestion. The hypnotist, by certain little tricks, is able to induce a course of action in the victim contrary to that which was originally contemplated. He looked at me seriously for a moment and then added, "Of course you and I have other powers than that. You will be able to hypnotize a person instantly even against a person's wishes. That gift is being made unto you because of the peculiar nature of your life, because of the very great hardships, because of the exceptional work which you are going to have to achieve." He sat back and gazed at me in order that he might determine if I had assimilated the information which he had given me, satisfied that I had. He continued, "Later, not yet, you will be taught much more about hypnotism and how to hypnotize quickly. I want to tell you that you will also have your telepathic powers increased, because when you journey from here far out into other countries you will need to keep in touch with us all the time, and the quickest and the most accurate way is by telepathy." I felt quite gloomy over all this. I seemed the whole time to be learning something fresh, and the more I learned the less time I had for myself. It seemed to me that more and more work was being added to me but none was being lifted off. "But, Honorable Lama," I said, "how does telepathy work? Nothing appears to happen between us, yet you know almost everything I think, especially when I do not want you to." My guide looked at me and laughed, and said, "It really is quite a simple matter, telepathy. One merely has to control the brain waves. Look at it in this way, you think, your brain generates electric currents which fluctuate in accordance with the variations of your thought. Normally your thoughts go to activate a muscle so that a limb may be raised or lowered, or you may be thinking of a certain subject at a distance. Whatever way it is, your mental energy is broadcast, that is, the energy force from your brain is emitted indiscriminately in all and every direction. If there was some method whereby you could focus your thought, then it would be of a very much greater intensity in the direction in which it was focused." I looked at him, and I remembered a little experiment which he had shown me some time before. We had been in much the same position as now, that is high up on the peak, as we Tibetans call the Potala. The Lama, my guide, had in the darkness of the night lighted a small candle and the light glimmered faintly around. But then he had put a magnifying glass in front of the candle, and by adjusting the distance of the magnifying glass from the flame he had been able to project upon the wall a much brighter image of the candle flame. To increase the lesson, he had put a shiny surface behind the candle, and that, in turn, had concentrated the light more so that the image upon the wall was even greater. I mentioned this to him, and he said, "Yes. That is perfectly correct. By various tricks it is possible to focus the thought and to send it in a certain predetermined direction. Actually, every person has what we might term an individual wavelength, that is, the amount of energy on the basic wave emitted from the brain of any one person follows a precise order of oscillation, and if we could determine the rate of oscillation of the basic brain wave of another person and tune into that basic oscillation, We should have no difficulty whatever in conveying our message by so-called telepathy, irrespective of the distance.